There's an insurance joke about how the policyholder has a loss, and they call their agent and say, "Hey, I had a loss. I want to know if I'm covered." And the agent says, "Well, tell me what happened. I'll tell you if you're covered or not." And the policyholder says, "Oh, no, 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 no. You tell me what covered, and I'll tell you what happened."
Enter an audio-visual experience like no other.
Underground rap at its realest.
We've had some contractors reach out asking about the purpose, role, pros and cons of appraisal. The main character in this discussion is one Roger Housen.
His legend precedes him.
I've got the most interesting job in the world. I'm an insurance adjuster.
He is the most interesting man in the world.
I call him the way I see it.
Helping you shorten your dang learning curve.
Drum roll. Let's get into the hot topic.
We've got some input from Ben Justison.
It is time consuming.
Input from our good friend David Princeton.
Yeah, the system can be ruined.
We've got our friend Bill Wilson.
Get a copy, your own copy of When Words Collide. By Bill Wilson.
We've got Andy McCabe.
Performing the functions of a public adjuster without a license.
Then Sean Scott.
Because you've got a good podcast with a pretty robust following.
Home of the Dojo Nation. Available on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify.
The key word is proper investigation. They can't just pull it out of their nether regions and say, well, that's not coming.
Epic comeback starts right here.
Place was a piece of crap, but you guys insured it. Don't assume that the adjuster you're dealing with knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
I would say this, right? If you are contemplating invoking an appraisal clause, like I think this is a good general piece of advice. If you're contemplating invoking appraisal, don't do it blindly. And don't rush into it.
Stay in your lane, bro.
The Dojo Podcast.
Oh, excuse me. I was just catching up on a little bit of reading. It's a thing I like to do from time to time. The No BS Guide to Internet Marketing for Restoration Contractors, revised edition from Benjamin Ricciardi. This is Ironclad Restoration Marketing. He has been a guest on the podcast. You can see his handsome face. But I believe when he says the No BS Guide, there's an element in there that I really enjoy in that giving away what you know sometimes has the great effect of possibly helping a lot of people.
They've done studies, you know, 60% of the time it works every time.
But what you might understand as a service provider is they also realize I don't really want to do this for myself. And so maybe they want to hire you. We did that all the time. There's an effective class we had with property managers was how to clean mold yourself. And then we would talk about the scenarios, you know, New York guidelines and those kinds of things. There are guidances out there that in theory, it's possible. I know the contractors out there and the hygienists are just gasping. And if they're going to do it, let's spread some good information on how to do it the right way, how to protect themselves and their people. And then what we would have is a lot of people, maybe they didn't call us for mold, but they might call us for this other thing. One job that came out of that was particularly gross, but just the tenant was upset, and so they took all the condiments out of the refrigerator and just painted the walls. So there's dried mustard, dried ketchup, dried globs of mayonnaise, and while that's not bloodborne cleanup or biohazard cleanup, it was tedious and just a lot of elbow grease to get that stuff off the walls. And I say that, I'm wearing my hat from my good friend Gordy Powell.
Well, dang it.
He just had his first online course for invoicing for bio cleanup, trauma cleanup, not drama cleanup, trauma cleanup, bio cleanup, death cleanup, those kinds of things. He reported that was well attended and had a good time. If you've ever met Gordy, you know he's one of the good ones.
Well, dang it.
And looking to share his knowledge, obviously charging for the course, there's nothing wrong with that, especially when it's good information and good content. I saw some good feedback from others. But just a shout out, coming up in April is the Restoration Industry Association convention in Reno. I believe that's the 11th through the 13th at the Peppermill Casino. But me and Gordy, last year we posted up in Orlando. They actually closed down the certain facilities with adult beverages rather early, and so we were able to post up near one of them, and we had some of our own. And so please, if you see, I'll plan on wearing this hat if I get it through security. Gordy always wears his hat, but don't be a stranger. You know, the 13 of you out there listening. Ben Justison was in town today, and he said we might have as many as 15.
You're nuts.
His wife listens, and she doesn't even like podcasts. So annoying and annoying but helpful. Here we are, 2022.
What would you say you do here?
The Diojo Podcast.
If you go to our website, thediojo.com/podcast, you'll notice Thursdays are for the Diojo Podcast. But you'll also notice our wonderful sponsors. We've got the RIA, the Restoration Industry Association. Join your fellow intentional restorers at the RIA 2022 International Restoration Convention and Industry Expo, April 11th through the 13th at the Peppermill Casino in Reno, Nevada. Let them know the Diojo sent you. We've got Office Services by Brandy. Provides unparalleled personalized bookkeeping services to a broad range of clients in many states. And the Restoration Technical Institute provides world-class training designed for those who serve the restoration, cleaning, and industries related to the built environment. As previously noted, we're working on an estimation course, Introduction to the Mindset and Habits of Estimation, built somewhat around the Ten Commandments from my book, Be Intentional Estimating. So please check out our sponsors. Let them know you heard about them from us. And we've got a few more coming down the pipe. Thank you for your support. So what is this all about? This is part two of a discussion related to appraisals. We're talking to public adjuster Roger Howson. Used to work for State Farm, and he knows a thing or two because he was one.
His legend precedes him.
I've got the most interesting job in the world. I'm an insurance adjuster.
Shares some really good perspectives on the appraisal process, but just kind of insurance in general. And we've woven together feedback from other people as well to try to give you a broad perspective of some of these interweaving topics. So anyways, let's get to it. Helping you shorten your dang learning curve, the Diojo Podcast. I tried to write an article. Your Miranda rights during an insurance claim.
Oh, very good.
Surprisingly, no one really wanted to pick it up because they didn't like the correlation, right?
Yeah.
But that's exactly that, you know, kind of like in the legal sense, answer the question you're asked, right?
Right.
No more, no less. Yeah.
And that is it. In terms of definitions and your Miranda rights, I actually do like it, John, because let's think of law and ordinance.
Yeah.
What happens is a lot of times, you know, there are things that you're going to have to do because it's the right way to do something.
Yeah.
And so it gets real easy for the adjuster to say, okay, that's fine. That's law and ordinance. That's code upgrade. But what happens is they end up maxing out the code upgrade coverage and say, oh, well, you know, hey, you've got $100,000 of repairs, but you got $40,000 in code upgrade. Here's your $40,000 and good luck with the rest of it.
Yeah.
The thing is, they still owe you to put the house back in the same condition it was before the loss. So if that has to be repaired, all the code upgrade is whatever incremental increase
specific
in material.
To, yeah.
That, you know, and
similar to mold, right? We have adjusters, you know, even if it were only water damage, we would still remove that wall. The specific mold is the air scrubber.
Right.
and
exactly
in the containment.
And so you have to do the careful math. But the other thing is, and contractors make this mistake, is it's real easy to say, well, we have to do it because of code.
Yeah.
And one of the areas is with electrical rewiring.
Yeah.
So if it gets wet, it's out.
Yeah.
Labor and industry, that's labor and industry.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is, it got wet. It was damaged.
Yeah.
That's a health and safety thing. That's not a...
Yeah.
Well,
if we
wouldn't
put
you know,
a different breaker in or something,
yeah,
or upgrade the wire or... Yeah. Yeah.
But those are things that the uninitiated don't pay attention
parsing
to. The homeowners don't pay attention to.
Because you've got a good podcast with a pretty robust following.
Sean Scott, you think with your silver tongue and your flattery, you can just finagle your way onto this podcast and interrupt Roger Housen? You're right.
I would assume you'd be an advocate for people to document their communications and processes all along.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing verbal, everything in writing.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, I wouldn't cut a fart in front of an insurance adjuster without it being in writing. I mean, literally, you need every single thing.
Did you hear that? You need every single thing in writing.
Yeah, I wouldn't cut a fart in front of an insurance adjuster without it being in writing.
I think this is important enough to interrupt Sean, who's interrupting Roger, who arguably is interrupting me. Write everything down.
Literally, you need every single thing.
Everybody in your organization needs to understand that. Write it down, write it down, write it down, right? You have a phone call, write it down. Send them an email. Send them a recap email just to recap the things that we talked about, right? That's something we're working hard on. Myself, our project managers and estimators, hey, I spoke to your adjuster. Here's a recap. Ben Justison was in town talking to our group of contractors, local contractors.
You're nuts.
And even encouraging, have the agent included on every interaction with the client and the adjuster. Who said it? Rachel Adams Beha at the AML Winter Break said, you can never have too much documentation unless it's wrong. Then you're really getting yourself in trouble and just furthering your issues. But recapping those conversations, here's a little snip of a video we did for our local contracting company to try to encourage inline customers, policyholders, the insureds, to do just that. Write everything down. There's a great resource called United Policyholders. They have top 10 insurance claim tips. Tip number one from United Policyholders: be proactive in the claims process and keep good notes. Make sure you maintain a paper trail.
I'm writing this down. This is good stuff.
So, in the event that you have an insurance claim, make sure that you're keeping track of dates and people that you spoke to. Hello, insurance company. I've got an insurance claim. Keep good notes. I'm sorry, what was your name again? Make sure you maintain a paper trail. I need to write that down on my claims notes. Let's kick it back to Sean Scott. What were you saying, Sean? About farts?
Because, you know, what happens is they play this game where they tell you, oh, yeah, go ahead and gut that room. And then you do it, and they say, oh, we never said that. And there's a legal theory or term that's called detrimental reliance. Mm. So when you are relying on a carrier's word and you do the work, incur the costs, and then they pull the rug out from you and say, oh, well, you didn't authorize that. They basically can be sued for that detrimental reliance because you did the work based on a verbal contract, an agreement that they would pay you for doing that.
We always encourage our PMs, like, even if they give you the instruction, follow up with an email and get the confirmation in writing. Or if you choose to move forward, at least you have some documentation that the conversation happened, you know?
Yeah.
Because they're squirrely, though. They will avoid, you know, putting things in writing. But
of course. Yeah. That's by design.
I need to write that down on my claims notes.
I remember specifically seeing you last year and being like, I need to go introduce myself. And then your fan base just, you know, I couldn't get through.
Yeah, it's more like security. He's back. He's scaring customers. What is the difference between a convention and a conference?
So ours is both.
Oh, okay.
And I think the difference being whether or not you have a trade show floor. And since we do both education and credits, where people can like earn continuing ed credits because of the education piece, and have the trade show floor with our vendors there, we're both. The I don't know if that's official. Don't quote me on that. Okay. I just made that up.
I know you did it.
You know, when we put together the education and we look at the vendors who are applying, there really is truly a focus on making sure our restoration contractors are going to get something out of this.
Yeah.
This is an investment. This is forward thinking. This is you're taking the time out of your business to come spend time with this group. We want to make sure you're walking out the door with something. And I think that goes into everything we do.
I think about with RIA, you have different ways that RIA has addressed various challenges that then change how we approach those in our business now.
That wasn't something I was 100% aware of. It's for restorers, by restorers, right? I mean, there's a small staff at the RIA that's paid, but the majority of the people that are involved are restorers that are giving up their time.
For me, I volunteer because the relationships that I'm able to build with RIA, they're just invaluable to me, and they help me in my business all the time.
By restorers, for restorers. And this year it's in Reno?
Reno, Nevada.
The Vegas of North Nevada.
I'm just goofing. New boot goofing.
Oh!
That's April 11th through the 13th, right?
And we've got a cast of beautiful characters here. This thing is like one big blended family, you know, where you've got blended family issues. You got a couple of crazy uncles.
If you're on the fence, come experience it once. You'll keep coming back.
The Diogo Podcast.
That's by design.
And then the other thing, speaking to your audience, that offends my sensibilities is, you know, the contract gets beat up twice. First by the insurance company, and then after the settlement. Then the homeowner goes, well, wait a minute. You know, there's got to be something in here for me. We have a joke in the business, and that is when you're doing insurance repair work and you're on a program, you're doing program work. The joke is you lose money on every job but make up for it in volume.
So obviously
that math doesn't work. The people that trained me said, you need to make sure your contractors are making money. Not bribery, not... But you need to know where their money's coming from. Because if you're cutting it so tight, then somebody's getting cheated. And you don't know. The other thing that I found was that when I dealt fairly with contractors, they dealt fairly with me. In other words, they would be the one saying, hey, by the way, the policyholder is going to try and claim for this and say that this was part of the law. It wasn't. Like, just like what you said early on, John. For me, the contractor is the canary in the coal mine. The other thing, though, that I don't like is that it I think it happens more now than ever, and that is they use the contractor as a stalking horse. Get the claim settled. And then give the job to their, you know.
Now, so another thing is, I can't remember the last time I actually wrote an estimate, because what I typically do is when I either, you know, been called in after a fire has been chased, is we sit back and let the adjuster write their sheet. Then rather than going out and giving a free estimate and then ballooning this, you know, the loss up to a point where the homeowner's like, oh, wow, I'm going to let my brother-in-law do this job. We just wait and we sign the loss based on the adjuster's undisputed amount. So now we got it locked up. And then I just do supplements. I did one, the carrier was at $127,000 for a garage fire. They wrote a check 3 months later for $680,000. Now, if I had been at $680,000 day one, I would have never got the job.
Place was a piece of crap, but you guys insured it.
So sign the contract with the customer based on the adjuster's undisputed amount, and then you're not actually starting work until you have the supplements approved, but you're starting those things that you can, such as permits and whatnot.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Because yeah. the other option, you know, the alternative is if you start doing the work, your PM is going to start doing work out of scope
yeah.
and incurring costs that there's no money for.
Yeah.
And then he's going to look like an idiot because now he's, you know, his budget's blown up and he's not making any profit.
Yeah. 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 Or you're literally gambling, right? You're literally saying, well, we're pretty sure we're going to get it.
Right.
We have done that in the past, you know, not probably not a better moment, but you write what you think the minimum is and what the maximum is, and then you budget based on what you know will get approved versus what you're going to be battling for, you know, so.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have these concepts. You know, looking, we're all well aware of the games sometimes that carriers play.
Squid Game.
When it comes to investigating a loss and determining coverage and coming to an agreement on the scope and cost, Sean just proposed, you know, one unique approach that has been working for him. Let's get back into appraisal and understanding what it is, where it might be appropriate. And David Princeton, our friend David Princeton, who has a new column in CNR, Dear David, that is, I believe, is very helpful, some additional perspective, outside perspective for contractors and your customers. But he's going to comment a little bit on provide the quid pro quo, you know, additional things that you should consider when considering appraisals.
So the appraisal can be used. So it starts out, right? The person, insured files a claim and there is potential denial or it's doubtful and disputed. Appraisal can be a piece of...
Yeah, you can demand appraisal. Appraisal is part of the... So all policies are based on a 1943 New York Standard Fire Policy. And that's the first time the appraisal provision appeared. And so you cannot have, as a matter of law, you can't have less coverage than that. So
okay.
that policy, and it's got 165 lines. It was really a two-page policy.
Policyholder just sends a letter or email to their
adjuster. They just say, I'm invoking the appraisal provision.
You have 30 days.
They can just say, I demand appraisal, you know, and they have actually 20 days to name their appraiser.
That's right. I saw that on your website.
The WAC, the Washington Administrative Code, says an insurance company can't, they have to deal with the policyholder. I mean, the contractor is really just an extension of all this. Deal with them fairly in that they shouldn't have to invoke the appraisal provision.
Yeah.
But if the insurance company doesn't put forth a good faith effort or a good faith offer, and then you go, well, we may as well demand appraisal. And I tell most people, you should just demand appraisal as soon as they give you a number.
Okay.
Appraisal is for resolving a dispute. If the insurance company hasn't given you a number, there's nothing to dispute.
Yeah.
I was talking to David Princeton yesterday, and there's times when appraisal can be initiated by the policyholder to help if, like, a claim is being denied. But he was mentioning... there may be some states like Texas where it can waive your right to bad faith claim. So you really want to know what you're doing when you're initiating it, you know, like anything.
Right.
I would say this, right? If you are contemplating invoking an appraisal clause, like I think this is a good general piece of advice. If you're contemplating invoking appraisal, don't do it blindly and don't rush into it. Right.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to say to the adjuster, well, pay this claim or I'll invoke appraisal.
Yeah.
It's not that type of a leveraged thing. In fact, adjusters, you know, especially like ones in Texas, they'll laugh and they'll say, go ahead. We'd love it. If I'm the contractor, this is what I would do. I would obviously come in and write like my full scope, right? Accounting for everything and anything I can. Take that full scope, present it to the insurance carrier. They're going to come back with some questions, right? So you go through that process. If that dialogue is so far apart, and I'll say it this way, if both sides are going to be so unreasonable,
yeah,
right? then it's a matter of the contractor being an advocate for their client or their policyholder would be to say, hey, you know, we think it's a good time to talk to a public adjuster, right? Or talk to a lawyer. And the reason why I would say that that's a good time to have that dialogue is because you need to know in what jurisdiction you're sitting in and what the effect of appraisal has. But more importantly, you need to understand what your rights are under the contract when it comes to it. Does it require both sides to mutually agree? Does it have the effect of extinguishing bad faith claims? Does it have, is it going to be binding, right? Is it going to be performed in an unbiased way?
Stay in your lane, bro.
So you got doubtful, disputed, demand appraisal.
Yeah.
That could potentially help you kick it into gear.
Right.
And then if they're non-responsive at that point, you're probably looking at legal, right?
Yeah. Well, first of all, they have to. I mean, then you own them. Then you can sue them because of the
they haven't responded to in your policy that says this is a resource.
That's a red line. That's it. Okay, we're suing you for IFCA, the Insured Fair Conduct Act.
IFCA.
So in Washington, the state of Washington, the Office of the Insurance Commissioner, Washington State, we have the IFCA, Insurance Fair Conduct Act, laws and rules. So it covers the unfair practices in general, remedies and penalties, unreasonable denial of a claim for coverage or payment of benefits, specific unfair claim settlement practices defined, misrepresentation of policy provisions, standards for the insurer to acknowledge pertinent communications, standards for prompt investigation of a claim, settlement standards applicable to all insurers. So, for example, in the state of Washington, the WAC, the Washington Administrative Code 284-30-370, standards for prompt investigation of a claim. Every insurer must complete its investigation of a claim within 30 days after notification of claim, unless the investigation cannot reasonably be completed within that time. All persons involved in the investigation of a claim must provide reasonable assistance to the insurer in order to facilitate compliance with this provision.
That's kind of closes that circuit to some degree in a real simplified form.
Exactly.
So now we've got the insurance company has accepted coverage. Contractors come out, written an estimate that they think is fair and accurate. Insurance maybe sent an independent adjuster or wrote their own. And obviously there's a disagreement.
Right.
And maybe a significant one.
Right.
So then, but the adjuster's not getting back, or they're digging their heels in saying, this is what we're going to pay based on
right.
preferred vendor, independent adjuster, whatever.
Exactly.
So then, is there a step in between? Are we missing a step there?
Well, you can negotiate. I mean, you know, you can just go back and forth and everything like this.
Do you agree, or do you see assignment of benefits as being beneficial for, because we say it all the time, the insurer's like, I don't want to deal with this. I don't know what I'm doing. We at least have the understanding of what we think should be happening.
Right. Oh, getting some reading in, Ed?
Yeah. Interesting stuff here.
A lot of the principles are those that come out of my mediocre book, Be Intentional Estimating.
Be Intentional Estimating, the most mediocre book available on the market.
There's nothing like it out there.
To change your mindset and habits, it all starts with being able to do it right, do it efficiently, and do it excellently. You cannot do it excellently if you cannot... You cannot do it excellently if you first don't know how to do it right.
Drum roll, let's get into the hot topic. So you've got the book. It is called The Book on Assignment of Benefits by Ed Cross, the restoration lawyer. Ed, what is an assignment of benefits and how is this a tool to be used for contractors?
An assignment of benefits is the transfer of legal title to rights under an insurance policy over to someone else who's performing a service. And Just about everybody who's ever had medical insurance has signed an assignment of benefits and probably doesn't even remember it. If you have medical insurance and you go to a doctor, normally the doctor is going to have you sign an assignment that allows the doctor to bill the medical insurance company directly. And that's actually a convenience to the patient. I know when I get a bill in from a doctor, I just wait until the next statement comes through that shows what the insurance payment is. And it saves me the headache of trying to chase money from the insurance company. So when a contractor gets an assignment on an insurance claim, it allows them to step into the shoes of the policyholder and collect directly from the insurance company. And they are very poorly understood. They've got a bad rap. There's been a lot of controversy. There's been some legislation. And that's why I thought it was time to go ahead and put out a book on this. And the book explains the strategies. It explains some of the things that I've learned in the process. It includes my personal assignment of benefits, which I now call assignment of insurance rights, because it's much more than just an assignment of benefits. And it includes instructions on how to present it to a policyholder and how to present it to an insurance company and then what to do if they don't pay on it.
And so we're used to doing that at the doctor. We assign away our assignment of benefits for our bodies. But why is it passed so differently when it comes to our homes, which obviously are so much more important than life itself, right? So why is it cast in a different light?
You know, at the end of the day, these things are really about impressions, if you asked me. And the impressions are driven very much by what is in the media and what the big corporations are talking about. And the critical difference that we have between medical and restoration is that the medical industry has a very powerful, very organized lobby. The medical industry is unified. The restoration industry has not been unified. And that's why the RIA formed the Advocacy and Government Affairs Committee to help unify the industry and put out information, consensus-based information about strategies that restorers can employ to help improve their businesses and achieve a fair result at the end of an insurance claims settlement negotiation. And I'm very excited to announce that in the near future, the RIA is going to be releasing a summary of the assignment of benefits law for every single state to its members only. This is just one of a huge plethora of members-only benefits that are available from RIA. And this compendium of the law of all of the different states can be used as a great counterpart to a good assignment of benefits or an assignment of insurance rights form, because you can take the law from your state out of the RIA book and incorporate that into a letter to present it to the insurance company when you're handing over your assignment of benefits.
We say it all the time. The insurer's like, I don't want to deal with this. I don't know what I'm doing. We at least have the understanding of what we think should be happening. Right. Do you have experience with assignment of benefits helping a contractor help a policyholder to be in the first party seat? Because we get adjusters that say, well, I don't have to deal with you. I'm dealing with the insured.
Right. Yeah.
Do you see assignment of benefits being a benefit in that scenario to where the contractor can say, you have to deal with us. They've signed the benefits.
So one of the things that, and I think it's State Farm policy, is that they write in the policy, we will deal with you, the policyholder. I mean, they in the
to try to language, circumvent.
Yeah, they say, nope, you can't get around that. Here's the lack of logic. Attorneys, they have to deal with attorneys.
Yeah.
If you name an attorney, that supersedes that, you know. Yeah. Well, no, I've got legal counsel. But if it comes to a contractor or whatever, that most of the carriers have now written in that they say, no, we will deal directly with you.
Does it help it or confuse or immaterial in the sense?
So let me, from a practical standpoint, John, I can tell you any number of adjusters would rather deal with the contractor than the policyholder.
Sure.
Because the contractor is knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And doesn't have a dog in the fight.
Or at least tit for tat, estimates or whatever.
So, but it is, and so what I would recommend to your listener is have your assignment of benefits, your contract vetted. Because what we've seen is, I know of one contractor who it took a major hit from a judge because the contract the insured signed, the homeowner signed, because we shouldn't call it insured, because really you could care less about insurance.
Right.
You're dealing with a homeowner who needs repairs done. You're dealing with a homeowner who needs repairs done.
Yeah.
Insurance is, you know, sometimes we kind of get locked up. That's just where the funding source is coming from. And it'd be like if instead of an insurance company, they had a bank.
Yeah.
If the contract is unconscionable or it has too many, in other words, too much of a benefit to you.
17 pages of ifs, ands, and buts.
And a lot of times it's like, so we've seen a lot of them where it gives the contractor power of attorney and all kinds of other things. And so the hard part about assignment of benefits is if it turns you into an adjuster, the way the commissioner's office looks at that and the attorney general looks at that is if it quacks like a duck, if it waddles like a duck, it's a duck and it better be licensed as an adjuster. Yeah. Stay in your lane, bro.
I believe this conversation was last year. Andy McCabe mentioned that a few years back he got into trouble in Oregon and was called before the state, an investigator for the insurance commission about adjusting claims without a license.
You get the phone call, right? Did you think it was like a fake phone call? Like
who? No, it was, she was good.
But this story by Andy is an interesting one. Something that we've brought up a few times where do contractors blur the line? And I know David Princeton comments on that saying, you know, when you're starting to get into insurance policy provisions, you're going beyond your realm as a contractor and into the realm of a policy interpreter.
One of the things that you've kind of flirted with in the past is, you know, what's the difference between a contractor and a public adjuster? Me, that stark difference is whenever you have to look at the insurance policy to know what an answer is.
And so I think it's important to, while I believe a lot of contractors do it out of the goodness of their hearts, believing they're providing a service, it's important that we specialize in what we specialize in and have resources that can help people with issues outside of our realm of competence and specialty.
I was so naive, and I wish I could remember the specifics of how the conversation went, but I drove to Salem with the idea that I was going to help enlighten this person on how my industry works.
Okay.
I swear that's where my mind was. I was like, all right, yeah.
Tell her.
Sure.
Catch me outside. How about that?
And this is an insurance investigator or what's
the... Yeah, the insurance division of Oregon has detectives or I forget what her title was, but she had a badge. Back in 2012, my primary purpose was I want to bring this knowledge that I've gained into the market and put it in the hands of the people who need it. And that is the insureds ultimately.
Is this about the time your videos started coming out then?
Yep. Yeah. So what I was writing estimates for homeowners and along the way, giving them so much knowledge on how to operate claims. Yeah. Someone said, well, you're being a PA. And in my mind, no, I'm not. I'm just talking about, you know, this. Well, you know how the story went. I mean, I went down and said the same thing to this lady. And she said, no, you better go get licensed.
Does that apply to contractors?
That's what I told her 7 years ago is, well, if I'm breaking the law, everybody's breaking the law 1,000 times a day. And she said, I will never forget it. She said, Mr. McCabe, we're not here to talk about everyone else. We're here to talk about
you. We caught you.
Catch me outside. How about that?
Yeah. okay. I drew a triangle with the carrier on top, the insured, and the contractor. And, you know, along my conversation, I said at a certain point, the carrier and the contractor start having these conversations. And she took my pencil, actually, and circled the insurer. She said, where's this person when this is happening?
Well, and the honest objection would be oftentimes the client doesn't want to necessarily be a part of those conversations.
That's
right?
What I told her. Never. I said, people file a claim and they turn their brains off. That's what I told her.
Was she insinuating that you have to have like three-way calls and things like that with the with the homeowner?
No, she didn't provide a solution. No.
Okay. But that, I mean, essentially,
she wasn't there for solutions.
But that would be the workaround, right?
Yes.
Would be that the customer
either a three-way conversation or have all conversations in person with the insured there.
The way the commissioner's office looked at that and the attorney general looked at that is if it quacks like a duck, if it waddles like a duck, it's a duck and it better be licensed as an adjuster.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, you know, you want to vet it through an attorney to make sure the languaging is very, very specific. You want to protect yourself.
Yeah.
But you also want to make sure, you know, the ad was stay in your lane, bro.
Yeah.
The tattoo artist, hey, stay in your lane, bro.
Yeah.
I guess not to belabor the point, but you definitely can do the wrong thing for the right reasons, just as you can do the right thing for the wrong reasons. But I think that's where a lot of contractors are thinking they're providing a service when perhaps you're not the most qualified or competent to go down that road. And so what I've done, and that might be crossing the line as well, I'm sure many of you have, where you say, my experience, you know, these are many of the factors that insurance companies look at. What we can do is help you document the conditions of the structure, whether that's moisture readings or getting some testing done, you know, doing the sketch, doing the photos, doing the 360-degree tours, videos, and in written format, you know, through an estimate or otherwise, just to state, hey, this is what we've discovered. If it's leak detection or plumbing or those kinds of things, having specialists comment on that, hygienists, those kinds of things. And, you know, it's surprising to me that there's not more of that collaboration between contractors and adjusters. It seems like contractors have a lot more of those resources with DocuSketch and Matterport, Magic Plan, the like, where, you know, oh, you're in the Midwest and this loss is on the West Coast, I can provide you a link to our 360-degree photos and captures, and you can literally, as close as possible, walk the property and take a look at everything going on. And we offer to do video conferencing and those kinds of things too. So it's interesting. But David Princeton has an article, like I mentioned, Dear David, in CNR Magazine, great resource for contractors and skilled in the area of policy interpretation, as is Roger Housen. Andy McCabe has become a public adjuster. So there are resources where people are coming with a contractor background and getting into those arenas to try to provide additional assistance. But I love that by Roger. Stay in your lane, bro. You know, do what you're good at.
So in my mind, it always starts with what the obligations under the policy are. And so to give you an idea, there could be what's called mutual assent, right? So both the insurance carrier and the insured have to agree to use appraisal.
Okay.
It can also be one-sided, meaning that either side can call for an appraisal and then the other side has to do it. Right?
So that would be potentially a scenario where if a claim is denied, then the insured could enact the appraisal process to try to get an assessment?
So it's not necessarily a denial. So the traditional use of appraisal is that you are just arguing about the cost of repair.
Okay.
So the narrower, newer precept to that is essentially one judicial decision, and I think it was an appellate decision, meaning that it's actually binding precedent, but it's not like it's binding precedent on all policies in all places, right? So whenever you're arguing about a contract, you always have to start with the contract.
Yeah.
So you can have broad, like a broad general sense. But step one, to quote Bill Wilson, is always read the full policy.
Yeah. Obviously, the things that bring you and I into conversation is a restorer that's trying to help an insured believes that there's a legitimate claim and then they're getting denied. Is there any value? Is that a resource for an insured to say, hey, you know, let's get an appraisal? I mean, is that?
Oh yeah, big time. So but I guess here's where lines could potentially be drawn. One of the things that you've kind of flirted with in the past is, you know, what's the difference between a contractor and a public adjuster? Me, that stark difference is whenever you have to look at the insurance policy to know what an answer is.
Yeah.
The tattoo artist, hey, stay in your lane, bro.
Yeah.
People will ask, well, how much does the appraisal cost or how long does it take? And second day of law school, they tell you the two words you will always remember for being a lawyer, and that it depends. It depends on who the carrier sends out also. Are these people looking for a war? Is it one where you're going to just, hey, let's just figure out what the loss damage evaluation is and move on?
So it's still to your benefit to try to maintain, be professional, but be direct.
For me, it is always mainly because what I tell people is it's a small sandbox.
Yes.
And if you throw sand, it's going to come back and bite you.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you roll over.
Yeah.
What it means is you're professional, you're courteous, and you know what you're talking about.
Yep.
And stay in your frankly, life. you call it the way you see it.
You have 20 days to name their appraiser. Then what is the provision? I saw on the documents, it doesn't look like there's a real clear they're held to a timeline then to actually perform the visit and produce the...
I had an appraisal that lasted 2 years.
Jeez.
Now...
So it's not a silver bullet.
It oftentimes can be.
Sure.
I've...
Because it shows it's now escalating, right?
Yeah. I handled an appraisal in 7 minutes one time.
Oh, jeez.
And you just walked in and said it's not covered. No. It wasn't a coverage issue. It was a damage issue. All right, you got to replace it. Everybody goes, okay, we're good. You can appraise. Here's the other thing. You don't have to appraise an entire claim. Mm. You can get
there's
to the
certain
point.
Certain area that's disputed.
Because what you're appraising are the disputes.
Okay.
So I had one where it was I was appraising the dispute over the electrical.
Okay.
And so what happened, and I was actually, in this case, I wasn't the appraiser. I was named as the umpire.
Okay.
And...
explain that. So the umpire comes in after the two appraisals are received?
Well, the appraisers name an umpire, and they're supposed to name an umpire within 20 days after they're both named.
So the two appraisers have to agree,
right?
This will be our mediator.
Well, or and it's in the appraisal provision, if the appraisers can't agree on an umpire, which happens a lot, then the court will assign an umpire.
Jeez.
And you go to court and have an umpire sign. And the reason you agree on an umpire early on is because once you're at crosshairs, you're not going to agree on an umpire either. So you should agree on an umpire before you disagree on anything else. Agree on an umpire before you disagree on anything else. Agree on an umpire before you disagree on anything else.
Yeah.
But
the umpire is non-binding, right? It's like mediation?
Well, no, the umpire is, so in the appraisal process, John, you only need two signatures on the appraisal award. If you've got two appraisers and an umpire, only two people have to sign the award. And I do this as an umpire a lot, where if I have the two appraisers and they're just being obnoxious, I say, okay, each of you give me your number. The number that's closest to the number I'm thinking of wins. Now, what baseball arbitration does is it forces the two appraisers to think kind of like the Dirty Harry Clint Eastwood thing.
Yeah.
How lucky do I feel? Do I feel lucky?
Yeah.
Because if I think my number, you know, well, I was really pushing for a high number to just kind of move the other numbers up. Well, if I'm out of range, then the low number is going to be the one that the umpire picks.
That's not
part of the appraisal process. That the umpire can decide how they want to do it. I've had, we split the baby a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it, you get to a certain point and then the umpire goes, all right, you're at 100, you're at 50, 75, we're done. Thank you, goodbye.
We're going to let Roger Housen close out this train of thought, but I'm going to introduce you to a conversation we had with Bill Wilson, author of When Worlds Collide.
So you said, page 34, why do you need this book? Many claims are denied. Why? There are probably four basic reasons. They're not covered.
David Princeton and I had the pleasure of interviewing him back on the Diojo podcast, episode 48.
Or there is no legal liability for the loss. There is a legitimate difference of opinion on coverage. I think that's scenario one and two. That's where professionals like yourselves come in, right, to try to say, okay, let's really dig into the weeds here and see what's going on.
About policy negotiations, and it's a very interesting and applicable.
One party is committing material misrepresentation or fraud, warning to all, and then cranial inversion, medically cranitis rectal inversio. But
here we go. Another poop joke.
You come out with stink like that, poop. Your poop mouth. Poop out of your mouth.
First we got talking about farts, and now we're talking about rectal cranial inversio. So let's get back to Roger, and then we'll pick up the conversation with Bill here shortly.
A lot of times, if it's gone to appraisal, the insured has filed an IFCA complaint and said, you know, the insurance company is not dealing with me fair. Nobody wants to go to appraisal, John. I mean, it is one where you go, well, they're just not trying. And I see it a lot. And the other thing that you're noting, insurance companies aren't sending their people out to loss sites anymore because of the pandemic for any number of reasons. So I go, well, you're not even trying.
Yeah.
You know, and part of it is it's effective.
Yeah.
See, the thing to remember is it's the law of large numbers. You know, you go, well, how can this work? They lose it every appraisal they go into. And you go, yeah, but how many don't go into appraisal? How many people just go, forget it? And
I just want my house back. Yeah,
yeah, I'll take my house back.
60 and, grand, whatever.
And they will move heaven and earth to find somebody that will do the work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you'll go, that's the problem for a contractor.
Brother,
that
uncle,
takes pride. Yeah. They go, well, I just can't do it for that. And somebody will come along and say, well, I can. And then they cheat. You know, they don't do some of the stuff they should have. Well, yeah, but, you know. And I've had contractors, the unscrupulous ones, they say, look, you gave me $100,000 for a $200,000 job. I did $100,000 worth of work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love what you say on the next page. All too often, they arise from ignorance stemming from substandard or no education or the failure or inability to read with comprehension what the policy forms actually say. That being said, most coverage disputes likely arise from legitimate differences of opinion about the intent of policy language or the proper way to interpret it.
From the standpoint of the restoration company or contractor not being a party to the contract, I don't mean to denigrate the value that they play in resolving the claim. It's like when you ask an expert opinion of a coverage person or whatever, these are the people that know what it costs, how to best do the job. And the insurance companies are interested in this claim not happening again, you know, a year from now. So they're willing to pay for that. So I think that the role that the restorer plays is an important one. And it gets back to credibility and dependability and reasonableness in the recommendations that they make. But I didn't want to imply that they don't have an important role. It's just that they're not the decision maker ultimately, but their input is critical in the proper decision being reached.
One of the things I think a contractor invaluably provides is a different experience and knowledge base. So one of the things I always encourage is don't be afraid to share the because. So Bill, you'll want to replace your door because these seals can fail. There's going to be some hidden latent things here that are going to take time to show. And until other forces are on that compromised surface, you won't know it, but you'll see it when it happens, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. And so one of the things that I've always encouraged is the fostering of dialogue and being willing to share those opinions and really seeking them out from contractors, because their breadth of experience and seeing what happens when you don't fix it far outweighs my narrow view of saying, let's throw some putty on that door because I'm okay with it that way, yeah. Right? As an insured policy holder.
So one of the best, and I can kind of leave you with this, another one, and I was the umpire, excuse me. And this one, the judges said, this is how much time, because it was so contentious. And a lot of times we're appraising things that are in litigation.
Yeah.
And let me say, the reason you want to do the appraisal is because then it sets the dollar amount.
Yeah.
And the judges like that, because then they go, we're not going to deal with the dollar. We're not going to argue over how much the claim is.
Yeah.
The claim has been set. So everybody's happy.
So as a homeowner looking at litigation, you're probably saving money by going through this process.
Yes.
If you can line it out. That was
I had one where it was the opening statement. Each side had 60 minutes to make their opening statement, the attorneys for the appraisal.
Yeah.
And the one attorney for the insurance company spent 59 minutes, 58 seconds. It was PowerPoint. It was beautiful. I mean, it was a spectacular. It was a very professional presentation. Then the policyholder's attorney says, well, I don't need all my time. Do you want some more time? And the other attorney, no, the judge said I only get 60 minutes. I took my 60 minutes. I'm not going to, nope. He says, well, I don't have PowerPoint. I don't have anything. He said, it was a motel claim. He said, place was a piece of crap, but you guys insured it.
Yes.
And got replacement cost. And I said, do you have anything else, Dad? Nope. And that was the end of his presentation. I mean, it was, you know,
yeah.
It was. You'd think, well, that was really unprofessional, but it was the most effective. And that's one thing that for your viewers, that's the problem. You've got a place that isn't perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
And they want it to be perfect.
Yeah.
And you know, there's hell to pay. That's the hard part.
Yeah.
And the insurance company, they're looking to go, yeah, but it was quite ugly before.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, well, yeah, but you sold them replacement cost coverage. And that's the other thing. You got to take something that's cattywampus and make it plumb.
Yeah. Deal as much as you can with facts and don't always go guns blazing, you know, at every provocation.
Well, yeah. And never actually, you know what, getting... one of the things that on our side, and as a contractor, you don't always see it, but I always learned whatever you put in print, whether it's an email, a text, or whatever, imagine it being blown up full size in front of a jury.
Yep.
One thing judges hate is, They don't love lawyers.
Yeah.
What they really hate are people who aren't lawyers trying to write lawyerly. So do not quote law.
So I'll close you with a story. Kind of insurance claim. I was driving, back from a job, and the guy in front of me slams on his brakes. I slam on my brakes. I come in and just kind of pink kiss, right? And then bop, I get hit from behind and bop, 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 there's this pile up.
Right.
And I can't remember if the guy in front of me hit the guy in front of him or not, but I think it was 6 or 7 cars.
Uh-huh.
Well, the trooper cites all of us, right? Everybody has some level, what do you say, no fault. Everybody has some level of negligence. So my brother's a police officer in Portland, so asked for some advice and everything. I looked up case law and thought I was prepared. I had kind of some notes. Well, I get to the court and the trooper's there, and I was like, hey, am I allowed to talk to you? And he's like, yeah, you can. And I go, the only thing I question in being culpable in this is I kissed the car in front of me. So I get it. I made collision by the letter of the law. I didn't have enough room to stop in the program at the time, but the guy that hit me bent my frame in my Ford F-150. I got hammered. And I go, is there any consideration for I think I was within the realm of trying to do the right thing. And he goes, oh, you know, that's not part of the court. And like, I can't remember what exactly he said. And I was like, oh man. So we go in there. He had slides, like you're talking about slideshow and all this stuff. And I'm just like, man, I'm going to jail or something. Uh-huh. And so then it's my turn. And exactly like you're saying, I was like, you know, dear judge, you know, blah, 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 blah. I thought I was cool. I was saying mm-hmm. some legal terms or whatnot. And the judge is like looking at me and I realized like, I sound really stupid right now. And so then I just said exactly that. I said, judge, I don't know the right terms or whatever. The only thing I would like the court to consider is, you know, I caused very minimal damage in comparison. And judge says, yeah, he goes, letter of the law, you're in the wrong. Intent of the law, I think the evidence stacks in your favor, and I'm going to dismiss this. And I'm like, oh God. So sometimes just being humble gets you a lot further.
I'll give you this one, and I saw it in person. So I don't know if you know this, but we're joint base.
Okay.
Cord and Lewis.
Yep.
Well, notice the base is on both sides of I-5.
Yeah.
So the state of Washington does not have jurisdiction over I-5 there because it's a federal installation.
In that strip?
In that strip.
Okay.
But only the soldiers know that. So if you get pulled over for DUI or for speeding, then Washington State does not have jurisdiction over that.
Okay.
And so I was in on another, because I testify in court all the time, so I'm in there and they're dealing with these, and it was three soldiers come in and they'd been pulled over, the one guy had been pulled over, but he brought his buddies in to see me. So he gets up to the front and he opens the law book to say, and starts reading the reg that says, you know, Washington State doesn't have
jurisdiction,
and the judge goes, I got it. You're done. Well, he's got an audience, so he wants to keep reading it, you know, and the judge says, you know, we can't cite you for this, you know,
contempt.
But I can cite you for contempt. So stop reading that.
Yeah.
But then what the judge did, John, was he let this, you know, they get up and they're kind of strutting out of the courtroom, right?
Peacocking.
He lets them get all the way to the door. And the judge says, young man, let me stop you right there. He said, you're right on the law. But what you don't realize is that expires as of March 1st. Because we've negotiated, because so much of this has happened. So from now on, Washington State does have jurisdiction over that part of. And what I intend to do is, I intend to hold every soldier to the fullest extent of the law. In other words, I'm bringing the hammer down on that.
In future instance.
But what I'm also going to do is I'm going to drop your name and tell them to thank you personally. You can go now.
I would say this, right? If you are contemplating invoking an appraisal clause, like I think this is a good general piece of advice. If you're contemplating invoking appraisal, don't do it blindly. And don't rush into it. Every day is a struggle. Quit the options. You can give up or you can get
lifted. This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
He who has the money has the control.